Medical Sciences Department at Cal Baptist University. My training is a biostatistician. We just started two majors in statistics, and this is the culmination of over 10 years' worth of work with a Danish perinatal cohort, which I'll be talking about. And I think the work is very interesting and very applicable. In the Old Testament, you know, one either has to approach a subject by looking at the Bible through your hand lens or by taking something else and then focusing it on the Bible. But the Bible has a very interesting section in, of all places, Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 4. I don't know how my reference got to be Job 24. I'll have to fix that. It is 1 Chronicles chapter 4, where it says, Jabez was more honorable than his brothers. His mother named him Jabez, saying, I bore him with pain. How many in the group would say, I've heard of the Prayer of Jabez? Okay, that was a very popular book recently, Dr. Bruce Wilkerson. Interesting about this section right here, in a whole series of genealogy, all of a sudden you have this stop and this exclamation by Jabez's mother that his life not only started with pain, but his name has something to do with pain, and the fact that he was born into trouble. And we don't know all the aspects of that, but obviously in these days, you and I are dealing with that. If you have seen just this last week, theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado, 12 people killed outright, 53 still in the hospital. Maybe some of them will succumb, with an individual who was raised in, of all places, lived in this area around Riverside here in Southern California. And entered a theater and began just to systematically mow down people. This is not only an epidemiologically significant issue. How do we raise people? How do we change people and transform people so that they live together, work together, love each other, and know God and honor Him? Or suffer the consequences of someone who believes in an amoral sense that even though they have advanced degrees in neuroscience from UCR, they can walk in and take people's lives with impunity. It's a significant issue. So therefore, as we look into this, let me start with a biblical verse which we probably all in the room, how many of you have heard Proverbs 22:6? Train up a child and which he'll go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. Used a lot, but this kind of idea has gone across cultures and across history in a lot of different places, that we are sure that if we do not train our children, we will not be able to see them grow up and become the citizens that we need to take over our society. Robert Frost, of course, has the poem about the two roads in the woods departing. I wish I had taken the one less traveled, and or I took the one less traveled, and that made the difference. There actually is two roads when it comes to looking into the background of how people develop and what causes them to change and take a different career or life path. One of those began very, very early, and I'm not going to attempt to bore you with 200 years worth of review of literature, but let me just summarize it by saying this way. If you look at the field from a sociology background in terms of why people turn out badly and what causes them to go wrong, it generally will be a whole series of research over two centuries that deal with either unskilled or semi-skilled fathers, overcrowded homes, family discord, a broken home situation, a depressed, neurotic mother, some kind of institutional care of the child. It could be early in life there was some kind of hospitalization and there was separation from parents and a lack of bonding that occurred, or even paternal criminal behavior. But these typical kinds of things, even as recent as 2010, our own government commissioned a report where they summarized over 50 different correlates that have been amassed of things that are typical of people's lives that cause them to travel down paths that lead them to trouble or to gang behavior or to some kind of criminality. But that is only part of it. Just because you walk into a garage doesn't make you a car. Just because you're born in a broken family doesn't mean you turn out necessarily bad. A different kind of approach and a second road in this whole field is the one taken by child developmentalists who began to look at the structure of how development occurs in a person's life. In other words, is it life stress and how that life stress somehow affects your social competence? In other words, you either don't develop the skills or you have some kind of quote-unquote arrested socialization. A very interesting work by Garmezzi, if you ever get a chance to read some of his work. He went back and looked at people who lived through the American Depression. And what he was able to find is you've got loads of people who go through that depression and they turn out to be stalwart, solid citizens, better than you can imagine, rock solid character. And you have other people who spend their entire life in alcoholism or criminality or some kind of vice. Why the difference? And Garmezzi's work began to focus upon some of these early life experiences that people go through. And particularly that there are seasons of life where you may be more prone and more vulnerable to some of these stresses than others. For instance, his work, interestingly enough, showed that if you were in the latency period of life, and I'm talking about 6 to 12 years of age, and you are a male, and you get hit with a depression, it is very important that your father and family are intact and guard you. If you don't have that, then it is overwhelming for you as an individual, and an overwhelming number of those people turn into lives of crime and vice and addiction. If you're a young woman, however, it is the teenage years where it's more important to have the structure and to have the support. If something devastating like a national depression occurs and your family loses their home and they're out of work, lots of interesting things. What kinds of psychosocial resources are available and how a person might use those to buffer those life stresses? You know, it doesn't take much of the reading of the Bible to realize there were a lot of people in the Old Testament who had significant life stresses and didn't turn out badly. In fact, it shaped them, it formed them, and caused them to form into a diamond rather than another lump of coal. So the summary of all of this, and Verner and Smith and others who've looked at resilience and things like that, is that not always do early life experiences overload people's ability to adapt, but there are cases where it does. And we want to find out where those are and be able to come alongside and help them. And secondly, there may be a second thing that goes on, and that is not only is the person overloaded, but perhaps there is some kind of continuing environmental pressure that throughout their lifespan is there, and they don't react well to that, and it continues to drag them down. Samaroff and Chandler were some examples of that kind of work right there. When they took and piled all of these things together, here is the mass kind of representation of the things that we've seen over and over again, whether we're talking about English schoolboys, or we're talking about people in Africa, or we're talking about inner city America in various cities like Chicago, St. Louis, Los Angeles, and other places. Chronic poverty, larger family size, criminal behavior of parents or siblings, mental illness of a parent, instability of the family and disharmony, and parental, poor parental techniques and poor supervision all seem to figure in terms of the weight and the stresses upon people who typically turn out bad. Now, I did not put the mugshot of the person who went into the theater in Aurora, Colorado, because I believe, like Haman in the book of Esther, we should all boo and hiss and make as much noise as possible and not mention that name again. So I will not do that. But if you look at the individual and you sit there wondering with the facts that we have available right now, you go, why? Why ever would this be true? Because there's lots of people who've had these kinds of things thrown at them and turned out well. So the research questions that we began with way back in the late 70s and moved through the 80s and 90s with was, is there an experience of living in a non-intact family, a father absent home, somehow associated with later criminal behavior? And then if there is a non-intact family, whether criminality is possible or not, are there other possible variables like timing and continuity of contact with the natural father? Criminogenic characters of people that you interact with, either in the home or in your environment. Are there certain specific maternal characteristics, like acceptance of situation, amount of education, abilities to manage affairs, that are so-called catalytic to a macrosocial environment, working together with SES, low SES, and somehow overpowering people? Or are there some for the person themselves, some academic or psychosocial competencies of the child, like doing well in school, athletic behavior, or the others, that tend to buffer those kinds of stresses and help people move on? And so those were where we began. And we started looking into this because we had a unique possibility, a unique opportunity with a Danish cohort to really look at this in a way that had never been done before. Let me make a couple of definitions here as we move into this. First of all, crime for this study here will refer to official records of crime taken by the National Registry of the Danish Police. We basically did a simple criminal analyzed count. This did not include traffic offenses, all right? We're talking about major offenses, which would include some kind of theft or burglary or some kind of an assault. Some major felonious type of assault would all be counted in those kinds of things. These are serious crimes, all right? These are not petty offenses. This isn't tagging a signboard or anything like that that happens once in a person's life. When we talk about delinquency, we're going to talk about people that are between 15 and 18 years of age. Now, with this cohort that we're going to be looking at, we have followed these people from birth all the way up until they are 18 years of age. We have complete records on everything. And being it is a Scandinavian country with the socialized medicine that they've had for the longest period of time, we know everything about them. In fact, it was scary because I was in a meeting about a month ago on data mining. And a Danish scientist was there saying, we have evidence and we have records on everybody that lives in Scandinavian countries. And as a statistician, I have access to all of that. I can match up your driver's license with your tax records, with where you've lived for the last 25 years. I have it all. And they let me use it. So it's kind of a sobering thought when we start collecting these things like national registries of health outcomes and things like that, what may be in the future we may be able to do, like we're doing with DNA now, and bacteriophage, be able to place and talk about individual atoms in the society, that's you, and how you form molecules and compounds and what interactions you have. When we talk about adult criminal behavior, we're going to talk about all criminal behavior that you're 18 or older. Okay, so basically what we have done is we've lumped delinquency and young adult behavior because we have lifespan data here. When I say recidivism, I want you to know this is not an isolated affair. This is where someone has had one plus or more subsequent criminal acts. If a person just has one infraction while they're a teenager, we're not counting that as recidivistic. All right, it's got to be one plus. It's got to be two or more where they're involved in some kind of repeat offense and it's ongoing. Parental absence, we divided into never residents, sometimes residents, or 11 plus, always residing in the home with the natural father. And by the way, when I say resilience, I'm going to say this is a characteristic of an individual who developed and maintained competence in spite of their stresses and strains, predictive of poor competence. By the way, I should say with this, stress is not always bad. Stress can be a U-shaped curve where, you know, if you've taught any time in academia, you know that there's a certain amount of stress to get people off their up to the top of the activation hill so the rest of the process can occur. And those are use stressors. We're talking about overload at some point, and what that might be for one person may be different from another. First of all, let me tell you about the Danish perinatal sample. We had a unique opportunity at USC. I was working with an institute there for 10 years. Dr. Mednick is actually Danish and had influence and contacts to go into Denmark and be able to collect over 9,125 individuals who were born at the same hospital. We were able to follow them on child development, collect maternal, socio-demographic, family structure, medical and other aspects of health, see whether they, you know, were making the charts, they were growing at the proper rate. We have all of that, height, weight, you name it. Over 853 variables by the time we got done with this thing. We followed these people from gestation, and then we followed them up year after year. You can see 1959, 1961 is when we started with this. We had a large variety of medical staff helping us. This was not a one-person project. This was a whole wave of doctors, midwives, midwife trainees, social workers, teachers, and other individuals who could fill out questionnaires and provide information on the individuals. They were given complete health care. The mothers and children and families were brought back. They were observed for a long period of time. And then from that, 9,125 in the original set of data, we then did a 10% random sample, which boiled down to 857. Why is that not exactly 10%, which is 912.5? We had a little bit of dropouts there. I'll talk about that in just a minute. But basically, we ended up with a sample of 857 as a follow-up that we were able to follow over the rest of their lifespan. And some of that, because people are volunteers. People move. People immigrate. And attrition does happen. There can be maternal death, child death, custody issues, maternal refusals, all of that we looked at. However, we did compare our dropout group with our remaining. Instead of having, 912, we had 857. What was the difference of those that who fell out? There were no real differences in terms of maternal age at birth, birth order, size of family, or stability of the marriage. The refusal rate, that 40-odd group that we lost, did have some differences in terms of when they were childbearing a little bit earlier. They were more teenage mothers and unwed at the time, and most of the time those 40 wanted to move on, forget about that period in life, and dropped out of the study. But as we look back at it, the group that we were left with was very comparable with the original study, and in fact, what we found, and this is, I think, is a highlight for our study here, when we looked at that study, we found the ones who dropped out actually would have, if they stayed in, made our results even more significant. So that's the good news. We don't have to complain about that too badly. The dropouts did tend to have a little bit lower mean SES in terms of the refusal rate, and so therefore they were... socioeconomic status, measure of how much you make and what kind of job you have. Yeah. Thank you for asking. So we had three phases to this. The first phase was after 1 year, we did a full spread of diagnosis and outcomes, examination of general physical health, neurological motor development that was done. Most of that was the medical phase, the health phase. And then with our 10% sample, that was all done in the 9,125. For the 857, we then followed that through two more phases where we began with social workers going back into the home, contacting primary teachers with questionnaires, school psychologists and school officials and anybody else that might have had contact with that individual. All of this is systematized in Danish records. I mean, it is unbelievably organized and thorough. In fact, it's kind of a sobering thing to think about that the Germans in World War II had such extensive records on the population that they could actually find people a little bit easier if they were looking for you. Phase three, we went again following up the 857. We went on to look at mother's health, some of the psychosocial outcomes of the child, and we did phase two and phase three concomitantly. And so we ended up with a ton of data. we were data mining back before we had all the nice things that we have right now. So the perinatal study is interesting because most of the time when people have looked at these social correlates, they have been snapshots at a point in time, or they have been retrospective, looking back at something that has already occurred. We had the opportunity of following these people from day one on through life to see what the outcome would be and what the influences would be and how those things might be influenced. So two real strengths of our data. Number one, it's defined, organized, collected, systematic, and carefully controlled all the conditions to eliminate as much bias as possible. And secondly, the sample provides a large prospective sample Mothers and children have experienced widely diverse family characteristics that were carefully followed over a long period of time. So we actually are looking at lifespan data here. And that was the first time that this has been done. And as life goes on, this becomes even more and more significant. So here's three things we should mention, three salient features. The group that we have is at medical risk because why would they go to that hospital? That was a hospital that was known where there might be problems with the pregnancy or delivery complications. And so it's a specialty center. It has a lot of medical support. And that is one of the biases because this typically would end up with more teenage mothers than the Danish population in general. But as I said, when we look back at those who did drop out, many remain, those who did drop out would have accentuated our results. Secondly, another salient feature is we had tremendous medical care for these people. So in terms of attributing this to poor health, poor eating habits, poor diet, or other things that might be related to poverty kinds of conditions, this was dampened here. And we found that we were able to do a pretty good job on that. And then last, the social background here, we did have a slightly higher incidence of lower social economic status, that would be more poverty-type people, and unwed mothers than the Danish population at large. However, we've looked into that, and we did some adjustments for that. As you can see with our data right here, in terms of the massive age group of the mothers, 18 to 30 is the big bulk of them. We have most of them are married, even though some of them were single, about 30%. We have, in terms of skilled and unskilled, the majority of them are skilled and working in some kind of regular situation. And so we were able to do our look back on this and say we've got some fairly good sample here to work with, and we can then use those things to be able to make some definitive statements. Three things that we went after that were kind of interesting. We went and spent time with the mothers. Social workers conducted a decade worth of interviews. They would go back again and again to the same situation. The social workers were trained, they were disciplined, they were taught not to ask the question in a biased way, when did you stop beating your dog? They were told not to do that kind of thing. They conducted these follow-ups, then they collected our data, and from those we constructed our scales dealing with things like maternal stress, things that mother found hard, the family environment and measures of discord, some of the poverty-related issues, SES-related, and some of the child outcomes. Having mother a comment about that child and that child's aggressiveness or patience or those kinds of things. We went to the primary teacher, and in Denmark there is a teacher who tends to follow that child all through school. Unlike our system right here, there was a primary teacher who had more complete information about that individual because they were following them much longer than just in the American system. And they were those who then did a follow-up phase. So we had teachers' academic, physical, and social competency variables that came from the teachers, how well they were doing in school. And, of course, we had complete access, amazingly enough, to the criminal records of all these people in terms of what kind of crime they had, how much crime they had, and when the crime occurred. So in terms of our study here, it really was significant. And we were able to get at some interesting things, which I want to share in just a few seconds with you. Because, I'm going to 3 minutes. I see that 3 minutes. I'm sorry, guys. It took me 10 years to get to this point. Sorry. Okay, well, I'm just going to flash through this and basically tell you, as we said before, mainly content on a 25-point scale, average contentment, disorderliness, desirability, most of these wanted their child at birth. Less than 25% said at birth, I didn't want my child. Lots of great stuff. Family size, 2.38, so they're typically a little bit larger family and the like. We did three stages with this. So let me tell you about three stages, and I'll have to cut down on the scale analysis, even though I love it. We began looking at the correlates, And I'm going to flash through that just to basically tell you that after looking at the correlates, we were able to say, here were the antecedent variables, the things that we believe before might have influenced. Number of years they were resident with their dad, and number of family constellations experienced. When I say family constellations, we actually had data where we could see exactly how many people were in the home, how long they were there, and what their interactions were. Then we said, once we know those two things, then here are all the mediators that possibly could influence it. Poverty, maternal attributes like her education, her satisfaction, her orderliness. That was our term for how well mom was efficient at ordering the home and planning and pulling it off. Parental role models in terms of mother and father criminal behavior, child cognitive competencies, that was mainly teacher data, and social competency, again, more teacher data, social responsibility, how socially responsible they were, early physical maturation, their aggression, their impulsivity, and their withdrawal. So we had lots of things, and all of these were aimed at getting at how much crime, how much recidivism will we see with these children as life went on. So we basically based our scales off three basic things. All of our health data, all of our maternal data, and all of our teacher questionnaire stuff came up after factor analysis with five basic scales: general academic ability, social inferiority, social responsibility, socialized aggression, and early physical maturation. And then we were able to pull off, with discriminant analysis, we were able to pull off the five top things that seem to be, you can see here, number of constellations is our last significant marker right there. The five major factors that seem to explain the greatest majority of the crime that we're seeing in the study. Now, given that, we were able then to actually line up a queue here and put people in piles, whether they never had a crime, just had one crime, or they were a recidivist, they were a repeat offender over and over again, based upon these kinds of factors right here. Once we did that, and then we were able to show, once we used the teacher's data instead of the general population data, it was a match as well. We were able to go to log linear modeling. What this did for us was we could then pull apart these various variables and look at three-way interactions. So here they go. SES, family instability, and crime was highly significant. What we basically did here was, and you guys probably don't want to know all the statistics on this, but we actually had a baseline model, and from that we subtracted out the various components and were able to find what the significance of all of that was. You can see here in the graph here, as number of family constellations goes up, crime goes up, especially if you're in lower or middle class families. So highest crime if you're in a poverty situation or middle class situation and you have a very disrupted family situation, you're going to have a high rate of crime with that. Not unexpected. Parental crime. If your dad's a criminal, again, highly significant. If your dad's a criminal, you probably are going to be a criminal as well. You've got a poor social model there, and they're feeding your criminal behaviors. Mom's education. The better educated mom is, the more buffered you are, the lower the education of a mother, unfortunately, the less buffered you are. The one question we had, and it was not significantly different, was why low and medium education really didn't make that much difference if you had three or more constellations. In other words, a highly educated mom who went through multiple family situations with multiple men coming into the house was no better off than a low educated mother who had the same kind of thing going on. Another interesting thing we can say about this is the grandparent factor. In these kinds of situations right here, the grandparents can step in and really make a big difference. Huge difference. Mother orderliness, unfortunately, there's a little bit of conflict here in terms of the three ways. We weren't able to show just for mother's order that just mother being organized kept you from crime, but we were able to show it did have some kind of an effect. Highly organized mothers have less crime, not significantly less, as you can see, between 56% and 46%. Mother satisfaction, of course, we would assume that the more satisfied mom is, the better off you're going to be. And that certainly was true. Social responsibility. Now, we're talking about the kid now. Is the kid more socially responsible? In other words, they're watching their actions. They want to behave. They want to be courteous, et cetera. And you can see, again, not so much for this side over here, but certainly over here, the more with the program, more courteous and more respectful you are, the more buffering you have against criminality, especially in high crime situations. Adult relationships, the better you are off with other adults and how you handle adult relationships, as well as acting in adult fashion yourself, again, is a buffer against crime. And another interesting thing we found was that, as rated by teachers, if you're looking across three or more constellations here, early physical maturation by the child seemed to be a protective factor. In other words, if you got into athletics and you were recognized for athletic ability, something happened as a result of that that then protected you against higher crime. One last thing. Assertiveness of the kid, again, was a protection. In other words, if the kid started taking responsibility for his own life and started planning his own actions in lieu of his parents not having that, he did much better than a child that was more passive and just let things roll in on him. This whole idea of train up a child and the way shall go and he'll be, you know, he'll not depart from it, you know, even the Greeks have recognized that courage can be learned. So I want to conclude with this. When we get back to the theater business, how do we protect kids and shape them for the future? Well, at any age, we know family instability is detrimental. You saw, if you looked at the abstract here, that the CDC is right now saying that, you know, more than half of our kids are growing up in these kinds of family situations. This is pertinent. Latency in early adolescence is a big deal, 12 years of age and under. That's why in the early 90s, when I read my own research, my wife and I committed ourselves to go out and work more with young people, camping situations, working with church organizations and groups, because we have a unique window there to take and shape people for life. In fact, what we could show was if someone stepped into your life recognizing either your early physical maturity because they're a coach or a teacher or someone, and that pro-social influence came into your life early in life before the age of 12, you would change that whole trajectory for the rest of their life. They may get into one offense, but they would never be a recidivist. Incredible. The incredible thing about this is, see, the Danish cohort is so one racial group that the results here in America are even bigger, depending on the racial group that you're working with. Here's some of the negative contributors. If you know people who have fathers that are involved with crime, or their mothers have problems with contentment or low education or orderliness, those are the people we need to step in and help. There's a group called Malakaya Dads right now that are going into prisons and working with criminal fathers. That is a great, great project, taking advantage of this kind of thing. And then, again, if we can teach people not only to get involved in sports, some kind of disciplining action, doesn't have to be athletics. It may be self-monitoring skills. There was a guy by the name of Weikert, I believe his name was, in Detroit, who was able to show that at 5 years of age, he could take kindergartners and work with them for a very short period of time, 6 to 8 weeks, teach them the self-monitoring skills, how to start a project and finish it, how to color within the lines. He did nothing with them until they were teenagers. He came back and then looked at them again, and guess what? His 8 weeks with him at 5 years of age meant that half of those kids didn't go into lives of crime. Hello? That's better than Head Start. Let me wrap this up this way. Proverbs 22:6 is interesting because that word trained is the word kanak. Kanak means literally put into the mouth. It was the whole idea that when a baby was born, you know, Peter in the book of Peter says, you know, as newborn babes desire the sincere miracle of the word that you may grow thereby. Peter saw his own little child picked up, taken by a midwife, over to a honey water mixture. They would dip their finger in the honey water, rub it around the mouth of the child, get them sucking on that finger, and then bring them back over so they could draw milk from mom. That's this whole work of Kanak. At the earliest age, we need to teach kids a delight in God's word, in social responsibility, in loving God and having a moral, you know, Ten Commandments, moral relationship. Later on in life, Solomon began to use this word kanak, talking about disciplining child. It was actually the word that went with putting a bridle in a horse's mouth to discipline it and train it. That's that whole latency period where we're teaching kids to conform, we're teaching them to go with the rules. If kids get that kind of discipline, it could be a sport, it could be some kind of training program, they're going to kanak. We're not kanaking them in the head. We're helping them get on down the road. And then last, in their teenage years, kanak then became the word meant for dedication of the temple. And so this is the great launch in your teenage years where you send that person off. You've been working with them as a child. You've been disciplining them through life. And then in the teenage years, you dedicate them for that purpose. And you train them in the way they should go because you recognize what their talents and their impact and stuff. As we say at Cal Baptist, your purpose. You live your purpose. And then when you're old, you've set a path for them. Very unlikely they're going to depart from it. It's kind of interesting. When it says when you're old, it says when you have a beard. Now, you don't have to wait till you're 70 to have a beard. Some of us in the room will tell you that. So this is not about a guarantee that at 70 years of age you're going to turn out right. That's why I believe Jabez would say this. Here's the key. Jabez's focus was not on his pain. Jabez's focus was on his God. And there is the correct reference right there, 1 Chronicles 4:10. Oh, that you would bless me indeed and enlarge my territory, and that your hand would be with me, and that you would keep me from evil, and that I may not cause pain. That's it. Thank you. Any questions? My wife and I, yes?
You talked about the father not being in the home and then the father as a criminal. I'm thinking about the President of the United States and his relationship with his father.